Gerslob at the 1984 Cantor's Assembly Convention at Grossinger's. When, where, how, and why did you decide to be a cantor?
I'm not sure. I think probably by the time I was 16, I had made up my mind. My father is a lawyer, and although I didn't know it at the time, I found out afterwards, I think after I graduated from the Cantor's Institute, that when he was a young man, he was invited by the Jewish community of Rochester, New York, to become a cantor, that they would pay his way through schooling, and he chose not to, for whatever reason. And I decided fairly early on that I wasn't going to be a lawyer. And I had one of the best cantorial role models that anyone could have, namely Sam Rosenbaum. In fact, as far as I know, I'm his only student who has gone on to the cantorate in the 38 years, whatever, he's been at Bethel. I started going to the synagogue with my father from the time I was 3. We went every Shabbat morning, and I enjoyed it. It was a wonderful time. He would point out where we were in the prayer book, even though I couldn't read Hebrew at the time, and he would find a special short tallis for me to wear. It was just a really positive experience. We went to the adult service. I didn't like the junior congregation as a kid. And then when I got into religious school, into Hebrew school, I had to go to that, but that was something else. And then I got interested in leading the junior congregation, and I progressed up the ranks that way. And the year after my bar mitzvah, I started teaching bar mitzvah for Sam. And one thing after another, when I was in high school, I was the teenager in charge of the junior congregations. I always enjoyed music. I always enjoyed singing.
When did you start an official formal music education?
Fourth grade. In third grade, we were all given a music aptitude test. I grew up in the Brighton school systems, which Brighton is a suburb of Rochester. And at that time, we were given a test in third grade. Anybody who passed the test had a choice of violin, clarinet, or trumpet. We got to hear each of the groups of instruments.
Klezmer,
actually. Yeah, right. well, they weren't doing klezmer at the time in the public schools. But I chose the violin for... I'm not really sure what... I like the sound. Something about the sound really impressed me. The trumpet seemed too loud, although a good trumpet these days is wonderful. And I don't know, the clarinet just didn't interest me. I studied the violin for 1 year during fourth grade until my mother made me give it up. She couldn't take the noise. So I switched to string bass in the fifth grade, and I continued with that until, I don't remember, either the 10th, I think the 11th grade is when I finally had stopped practicing on the bass and was feeling guilty, not about not practicing, but about wasting the time of my instructor, who was a bass player with the Rochester Philharmonic. And I mean, this man is obviously committed to his instrument, and I was not, and so eventually I dropped it. And in my senior year of high school, I started taking voice lessons from the man who had recently retired as our director of music. Oh dear, what was his name? I can't remember his name. Dr. Nice old man. Didn't learn much. Vocally, I don't think. Then I went to college. I spent 2 years at the State University of New York College at Fredonia. I was in the applied music department at the time. It had a big music ed department and a very small applied. I was in the applied. Studied first with, my first year with Mario Alsch, who was a German opera singer. He didn't last long on that faculty. He had some interesting breathing exercises that caused a number of people to hyperventilate. Didn't happen to me. I didn't learn much from him. And then the second year I studied with Tony Barisi,
Italian.
Yeah, I'm not sure what I learned from him either.
By this time, were you studying voice with the most in mind of being a chazan?
Yes. I had gone to college with that intention. In fact, Sam had given me some chazonis to work on as well. And every once in a while, if I was able to do it, I would do it at a studio recital or an area recital or something. One year when I was taking the Bible as literature, instead of doing a final paper, I did a mini recital of biblical texts in Hebrew for the class. So that was interesting. It was an easy way of getting out of the paper. But so I spent 2 years at Fredonia. Became a campus radical. I was already a radical in high school, but
What year are we talking about? The late 60s?
I was born in 1952. I graduated high school in 1970, which was the year of Kent State. And the peace movement was very active, and I was reasonably active in it. When I got to college, I became a draft counselor. I was a conscientious objector. Also, from the time I was 16, I was convinced that there was no way that I would be able to fight in a war.
Is your family traditionally liberal?
Yeah. Yeah. My father served in World War II, had himself transferred out of the tank unit into a medical unit, and was so against the military, really, that even as a kid, although I never had a desire to do it, he didn't want me to be a Boy Scout because he didn't want me to wear a uniform. He's so much anti-uniform. I think it's... And my mother is very liberal.
Is your father descended from the 30s wave of Jewish liberal thinking East Coast Jews? You know, it's an identifiable group.
Yeah, it is. I don't know what his father believed. I never met my father's father. I met my mother's father. He died in 1972. And he was liberal. He was very pro-union.
Was your father involved as a lawyer in liberal causes?
Not really. Not really. In fact, when he was in college, he'd done some work, or law school, done some work for the Republican Party. For many years was a registered Republican because he was getting work from the party. He didn't vote Republican. He voted Democrat for the most part.
In regards to the Second World War, did he ever mention any conflict between knowing what was happening to Jews in Europe and not wanting to sit in the army?
We never talked about that. Never had any discussion. The only stories I ever heard about the army, and he never went overseas, were his getting bounced out of a tank because some guy decided he was going to run over a tree, and after he came back or on leave, he would have nightmares about ammunition rounds going off and things. My general impression was that the army was a negative experience for him.
All right, so you had 2 years at Fredonia, then you went right to the seminary?
Right. I took my interview at the seminary after my first year of Fredonia and decided that I still wasn't ready to go to New York City. Growing up, Rochester is not that large a city, and Fredonia was a very small college, about 5,000 students. And I wasn't ready to hit the big city all by myself. So I delayed my entrance for a year. Besides, I was having a good time on campus, the administrative head of the campus draft counseling center, which was operated in conjunction with the college counseling center, the psychological counseling. And I was busy and I was involved and interested. After my second year of college, I was no longer interested. and so I decided to go to New York.
And you jumped into the candidates.
Right. Actually, I went through it in 5 years. The reason being that in what was my fourth year, I took the position as Chazan Sheni at Park Avenue Synagogue. Under Putterman. It was Putterman's last year. David Tillman, who's now in Elkins Park, was my predecessor there. And he was already teaching at the seminary, and he was just getting his master's from Juilliard in conducting. And he decided it was time to move on after 6 years at Park Avenue. And I took over that position. It really was a seven-day-a-week job. I was there every day.
Did you involve yourself in any of Petterman's pet projects, the commission and performance of modern music?
No. The opportunity never came up. David was beginning to retire. He was getting ready, you know, really to wind down. It was a very difficult year for me. It was there that I learned an important rule. Never follow a legend. Tillman was a legend. He was greatly loved by the kids and by David himself. And I could not, in David's eyes, fill David Tillman's shoes. So it was a difficult year. I had to read Torah every week, and although I was good at it, in the beginning of the year it took me 15 hours a week to prepare.
Did they do the whole set of
it? No, it was a triennial reading. But afterwards, the rabbi would come over and not in a mean way, but in an instructive way, say, you know, you made 6 mistakes this morning, and these were the mistakes. To really, his intention was positive. It was to increase my knowledge.
Made you feel like.
But yeah, it was. You know, it wasn't. They watched like hawks. I had some different ideas about teaching bar mitzvah than Putterman had, because I had already been teaching since 1966. You know, this was in 75, so almost 10 years. Putterman had the kids meet all together in a class, and they all had the Hertz Chumash, and they'd have to sit there and listen while one kid did his recitation. But nothing could be more boring than to listen to another kid. So there were discipline. It was a lot of experience. I learned a lot. I don't think I would have done it any differently. And the opportunity of working with Putterman, for better or for worse, was a tremendous learning experience.
Who at the seminary, for instance, would you say were the biggest influences on you?
Well, Max Wolberg, certainly. Ben Belfer, I studied voice with Ben when I first came to New York, because we were required to study voice. I didn't know any teachers. I didn't have a lot of money. And I knew that Ben was teaching both at JTS and at HUC and had private students as well. And he has a wonderfully powerful voice. So I studied with him for a while. David Kuzovitsky. Because I had 5 years, they gave me an extra year of coaching, and I was able to get an extra year of coaching with David, which was marvelous.
So you think you've adopted Wolberg's intense commitment to Nusa, for instance?
Yeah, I think he's managed to instill that in almost everyone, all of his students. I mean, he's very, very strong on it. And to this day, for instance, in our Shabbat morning prayer book that we have, which is based on Lekrat Shabbat Machzor Chadash, after the Baruch Hu, after Yotzer Or is Or Olam B'Yotzer Chaim, the first line of the Piyut for Yontif, either for the three festivals or for Rosh Hashanah and Kippur, because he took it out of the Machzor, but he forgot, when the rabbi cut it up, he forgot to cut off that line. So to this day, on the Shalosh Regalim, when we also use that prayer book, after Yotzer Or, I'll sing that first line of the Piyut, according to the Nusach that Max taught us. So, and whenever I can, I do things in Nusach, and I try. It's not the hardest rule. It's not the most firm rule that I have. But I try to choose congregational tunes that fit the Nusach,
when
I can.
When I can.
Yeah. But for instance, Micha Mocha is always in the Nusach. But I won't do the Friday night Micha Mocha tunes on Saturday morning and vice versa. That sort of thing.
Is your congregation sensitive to it? If somebody got up and used Yom Kippur or Nusach on Shabbos morning, would they know?
They might.
They might.
They might. They'd know it was different. That I know. Of course, I never get to hear anybody else daven from my pulpit. Only
has
when
it
I'm.
Happened?
Oh yeah, when I'm out of town.
Have you ever got a complaint that he didn't know what he was doing this hour?
No, the complaints were that he was a little nervous, that it wasn't as smooth as it should be, or that he didn't seem to he got lost in a couple of places. There doesn't really seem to be an attention to the Nusach, although they seem to recognize it when they hear it. They can say, well, that sounds like Nusach, or something.
Now, we've got you as far as, let's say, graduated from GTS.
Right.
How many positions have you had in the meantime?
Okay. When I was a student, my first position as a student was in my fourth year at Park Avenue Synagogue. And then as Chazon Sheni. And then my fifth year, my last year, I was the Chazon in New London, Connecticut, at the Conservative Synagogue there. I drove up on the weekends from New York and would conduct the services. I would teach Bar Mitzvah Friday afternoon when I got there, a little bit Saturday afternoon and Sunday afternoon after teaching Sunday morning. So it was kind of a very busy.
They paid you well for
me. Reasonably well. As student jobs went, it was well paying. The best paying job was the Park Avenue job. But I just couldn't do it in my final year with two recitals and comprehensive exams. It was just too much pressure. Also, at the time, I was president of the student body of the Cantor's Institute. My last 2 years of school, I was president of the student body and student placement chairman. So I kind of had my pick of the jobs. I mean, I knew what was coming in. Had a chance to work very closely with Paul Kavan, which was also a marvelous experience.
So then New London was just that 1 year.
Right.
And then
I went, after I graduated, I went to Albuquerque, New Mexico. I kind of fell in love with the Southwest. My grandparents lived in Tucson, Arizona, and came east from at the end of June until Simchas Torah. And when my grandfather got sick, I flew out to Arizona and packed up their apartment and drove his car back across country. I did that twice. I really fell in love with the West. And when the position opened in Albuquerque, I said, Paul said, well, yeah, Albuquerque. I said, send me there.
Are you still there now?
No. That only lasted less than a year. We did not agree on how to do things. I'm very medakdek about accentuation. I think Hebrew should be properly accentuated and should be properly pronounced. Well, they weren't so convinced about that. They wanted the bar mitzvahs to chant as much of the service as they possibly could, whether they knew what they were doing or they didn't know. If they didn't know, the rabbi would stand at his pulpit and coach the kid through the service. And it really was disgusting. And I said, I kept fighting against it. And my predecessor there, who was not a formally trained cantor, had them doing the Saturday morning service from sheet music. And I said, no. The first bar mitzvah, who had already prepared and was planning to do it, I let him do it. After that, I said, absolutely not. Only from a prayer book. I mean, if a chazan uses sheet music because one has 10 settings of Hashivenu and you don't want to mix one up with the other, it's not because you need the transliteration to get through the text. This was disgusting, and so I put an end to it. They didn't like it. We had a lot of disagreements, and so it ended in the middle of the year.
Just stay in the West.
I came back to Rochester and spent the remainder of that spring with my parents. Worked as a sound technician for my friend's rock band.
That's one of the more
traveled on the road. Yeah, Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And then I got the position in San Bernardino, where I am now.
You look Western with the boots and the turquoise well, and the shirt. I was wondering.
The first pair of boots that I got was in Albuquerque. Everybody wore boots, and I could wear jeans to the synagogue and teach, you know, during the week. I mean, obviously not on the pulpit, but it was very informal. Actually, the ring I had gotten a few years before, my friend's band was playing at a New Year's Eve party in I can't even remember where, someplace.
I should describe for the tape that that Kander Yaroslav is wearing a Navajo turquoise ring, tan cowboy boots, and a short sleeve white Western shirt, which garb is unusual for this group meeting at Grossinger's.
True. But this guy got snowed in. Everybody got snowed in at the Holiday Inn. He was transporting rings and Indian jewelry across country. This was in Western New York State. And in order to pay for his room, he sold these things at cost or whatever. So I got many years before. But I decided I like the boots. They're very comfortable. So I still go back to Albuquerque to buy the boots, and the guy at the boot store remembered me after not seeing me for 4 years.
Which is a customer for life.
Yeah, nice place, you know, the good select. Anyway, so
After Albuquerque,
I came back to Rochester, and then I went out to San Bernardino. Again, Paul called me on the phone and said, "There's an opening in this place called San Bernardino. You know, who ever heard of this?" And he said, "It's a Reform congregation, but..." And I said, so, you know, because although I went through seminary training and grew up at Bethel in Rochester, very conservative, traditional conservative. My father went to shul every Shabbos morning, but we didn't keep a kosher home, and we weren't strictly Shomer Shabbat. That didn't bother me. And I prefer riding to shul than walking any great distance, because what do you need to be out of breath before you have to sing? So this rabbi called me, and we had long talks on the telephone. And I liked what he had to say, because I was displeased with what happened in Albuquerque, and I wanted him to know up front my mishigas about accentuation. And I said to him, "Do the kids chant the service?" And he said, "No, the congregation hires professionals to lead them in prayer, and it expects that the service be conducted in a professional manner." Fine, and I agree with that. I think that kids can learn basic nusach if it's a part of the religious school experience, but it really has to be well integrated. And their Hebrew has to be better than what most American kids have as Hebrew these days. It's bad all the way across the country, except in the day schools and the yeshivot. And that's not praying. That's not davening.
Were you at Ramah either?
No, I never went to Ramah. I don't know. Primarily because my grandparents only were around in the summertime, and I didn't want to be away for a month because they were only there for a couple of months. And my parents didn't have a lot of money, and it was and is expensive. And in a way, it was too observant for me, it seemed. At least I had a good friend who always went to Ramah. And one of my best friends growing up always went to Ramah. And it just seemed too... more intensive than I wanted.
So what happened in San Bernardino?
Well, I've been in San Bernardino since July of 1978. I've just completed my sixth year there, and last week, the end of the week, just before I came here, we signed a contract for another 5 years.
Very happy.
Yeah.
What's your relationship with the rabbi?
Very good.
Is he sensitive to what you want to do and allows you the leeway to do it?
For the most part. He respects my limitations. There are things that I simply will not do. Well, for instance, for our family services, once a month we have a family service where we have the basic prayers. You know, you got,
like a Saturday night?
Friday night.
Early Friday?
No, actually, it's at the regular time.
It's a regular Friday night service.
But it's at the regular time, but we use a different book. It's a pamphlet, and it's all tunes, basically. There's no davening in there. There's no recitative in there. But it follows the outline of the service. And you have something to introduce the service, you have something from the Psalms, you have a fragment of Lechadudi, maybe one of the 92 or 93 after the Baruch Hu, a tune after that came Chayenu or something.
So
Shema.
Solos and congregational singing.
Yeah, almost no solo. It's almost entirely congregational singing.
Is there a choir there?
No. No. This is just, you know, families, and they bring the little kids, and instead of a sermon, the rabbi tells a story, and the kids come up for Kiddush. You know, they all get a little cup, and it takes an hour. It's okay. I mean, it's not great. I'm not threatened by it, as many of my colleagues seem to be threatened by incursions into the liturgy or reductions of the service. That doesn't threaten me, because that's not what that's for. It's for the people who have young children, and they can't sit all night, and they're not going to listen to that. So at least they come to the synagogue, and they have a good time, and they have a positive experience in the synagogue. These people are not liturgical to begin with.
How big is your congregation?
560.
And there's the normal Friday service Sunday.
On the other three, yeah. Yeah, and this is only from September to May or June, you know, once a month. And usually we have a dinner for each class in the school before that. So it's a way of getting people there. Anyway, where was I going with that? He had a version of a Hebrew version of the Yiddish folk song Azichel Zingen Lichadoni, but it was Hebraicized. And he wanted me to sing it with the Yiddish accent.
Hebrew, Yiddish accent.
Yeah,
and
you know.
Ashkenazi and a lot of words.
Well, no, with primary syllable accents instead of ultimate syllable accents. But the Hebrew went the same way. Okay, and I said no. If it's going to be in Hebrew, then we're going to sing it in Hebrew. If you want Yiddish, then put the Yiddish text in the prayer book. He said, well, the prayer book is already done. We have never done that. Because I said to him, if you announce that one, I will sing it in proper Hebrew. And that's all I said.
It doesn't really work,
I imagine. Sure it does. I don't know.
It just needs a moment to say
it. Yeah, and he wanted... So no, if you want that, then Azich will sing in Lichadodi, then do it in Yiddish. You know, I mean, either one or the other, not mixed.
What do you think was his thinking in doing it in Hebrew rather than Yiddish?
He found it in a book someplace when he was putting this thing together, and he cut it out and he put it in there. That was his thinking. You know, and the tune, because the Yiddish tune, everybody knows the Yiddish tune. But it's not right.
So what was the result?
The result is we don't do it.
Don't do it.
We don't do that one. We do, he's got other, he's just got the refrain of Lechadodi, and then the one that where he sings Shabbat Shalom, Shabbat Shalom. So, you know, things like that. He grew up, his father was a rabbi in Germany, an important rabbi in Berlin. Was arrested on Kristallnacht and let go after they kicked him down the stairs. So when I came and I taught the choir to sing the Ashamnu, and I added the little the nigun thing, and he walked into the temple one night. We were having choir rehearsal, and we were just rehearsing that thing, and I mean, his eyes lit up. Like he hadn't heard it since he was a kid. So he likes traditional things, and he knows from Nusach
you must represent in this synagogue a turn to the right to some extent.
Liturgically,
yeah.
Liturgically, which I mean, he's a Reform rabbi, a graduate of HUC, of the older generation. I mean, he's 45, but he doesn't, he acts older, rabbinically. Possibly, yeah, this you know, formal German background of his. Although his father was a liberal conservative rabbi in this country, and was the rabbi for the blacklisted Hollywood people, primarily because he was a liberal. And the people who were blacklisted during McCarthy went to Franklin Cohen as their rabbi. And Hillel himself is also very liberal. He got in trouble during the late 60s. There was an anti-war protest, and he took a Torah out of the Ark and marched up the main street. The bishop had his cross, and somebody else, the Greek guy, had something. And so Hillel, what symbol? He couldn't take the Israeli flag, because that's Israel. So he took a Torah, and the board had a fit, I'm told. And then the first year I came, at the end of the year, Carter had reinstituted draft registration. We had a large meeting in one of the churches downtown. We did a mass draft counselors training. I was interviewed by the local newspaper, and it just identified me, and it said that I was the cantor at the Congregation Emmanuel. The day that that article appeared was the day that I was scheduled to leave for my month's vacation. I got two phone calls that morning, one from the rabbi, the other one from the Ku Klux Klan. The rabbi said, "Do you know what you did?" I said, "Yeah." And he said, "Well, there's going to be some repercussions." I said, "What?" He said, "I don't know." I said, "What do you want me to do?" He said, "Leave town. Go away on your vacation." He presented a 3-page position paper to the board on the rights of clergy to speak their mind. And the board instituted a policy that no one would use the temple name without prior authorization from the board. And I said, "Look, I didn't use the temple name. They simply identified, if I'd been a garbage collector, they would have said Gregory Yaroslav, a garbage collector for the city of San Bernardino."
But you
didn't
get fired.
I didn't get fired. Didn't get fired. And so things have calmed down. He is active in the nuclear freeze movement, and so am I. We both do a lot of interfaith services, peace services. Oftentimes, although sometimes he'll do one and I'll do another one someplace else.
Can the congregation actually tolerate this?
Yeah, even though we have people working on the MX program, directly on the MX, because
they're sometimes among the biggest, you know.
Well, no, very conservative. The people who work for the government, we have Norton Air Force Base and TRW, which is doing a lot of the MX work. These people aren't real happy about this.
But the majority of the congregation must in some sense be sympathetic.
Either sympathetic or, here goes our clergy again. You know, but the rabbi has a life contract. And the congregation in 100 years has had 4 rabbis. Very stable. The previous rabbi was there for 35 years, and he's still around as emeritus. And Hillel has been there. It was his first position out of seminary.
Things sound pretty good where you are. What is your prognosis in general? In other words, if you were writing a book on the cantorate in America and wanted to give some kind of a future forecast, either optimistic or pessimistic or a combination, what would you say are the most important things on your mind regarding the establishment of synagogue music and its continuity and so on?
I think that we're not in bad shape. Change is in the offing, but change is always in the offing. I mean, Kaplan was right when he defined Judaism as an evolving civilization. It always changes. And so Chazanut must change. We don't have the age of the star cantors. Sure, we've got a Louis Danto, and Ibn Mizrahi, and Verves who. But if my colleagues will be flexible. I guess I'm really, I may not really be a conservative Jew. I probably more of a Reconstructionist, which I think most American Jews are, even if they don't know it. That God will hear our prayers in whatever form we choose to pray to Him. And that if we don't say both Hamari Varavim and Ahavat Olam every week, it's not going to make a big difference. Or if you only do half a piyut instead of the whole piyut, I can't believe that God would keep track of that. That the purpose of religion is to teach people to live righteously. And the purpose of the synagogue service, and especially of the chazan, is to access people on the subconscious level. Because music is not a conscious thing so much. I think the people who invented Muzak know that. And when we reach people, and I reach people, I mean, there are times when I sit and they cry, if I do Es Brent, or if I do Safam's We're Leaving Mother Russia, you know. If I'm crying, they're crying. You know, and I can see that I'm reaching them. And if I'm singing in Hebrew and they don't understand what I'm singing, or I'm singing in Yiddish, and but they still know. And that's our job, is to reach people, to give people a religious experience, a connection to the cosmic, a pathway, a road leading to a cosmic experience. God doesn't need a cosmic experience. God is a cosmic experience.
God doesn't even need our prayers.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you know, we're taught that that's one of the reasons that human beings are on Earth is that God does need our prayers, and that's why we're Nam Kadosh and you know, holy people and chosen in that sense. I don't know. You know, I really don't know. I'd hate to say that God doesn't need our prayers, but whatever our prayers are, ought to be acceptable to Him if they're done with the proper intention. The prophets didn't like the sacrifices because of the intention. There was not a holy intention behind it. You know, I mean. So God has been listening to the same prayers for 600 to 1,000 years. So maybe they're being a little bit abridged, and there are more people praying to God now than ever before. So he may be a little bit busier.
You just gave me a good answer to a question. Someone asked me last night how I would define religious music. And I said, music which is written out of the conviction to write religious music. And
yeah.
The answer is, it's like the sacrifices in the Mikdash. If it was done with the correct intention and the heart was directed to right direction,
mm-hmm.
then it was a religious act, and
right.
if it wasn't, it was a blasphemous act.
Right. So if, you know, if my colleagues are willing to use a California term, go with the flow, to meet people where they are, and to give people what they need, God will take care of Himself. I think if we serve our people, we will serve God. And I would hope that the question of women in the cantorate will be resolved soon. Unfortunately, there's not only is people hide behind the halacha to hide what really is the bottom line, which is sexism, and not even so much sexism, but self-protection. That people who might not be as qualified as they should be are afraid that a woman might take their job away from them. And hopefully that kind of bigotry will...
Or price warp.
Yeah, although I think if... See, it could happen if the assembly doesn't take women in. If the assembly takes women in and they become bound by our regulations, as we are all bound, and we ought to be, then there won't be a problem. If they have to create their own competition to us, Then we're going to be at Cirrus.
You know, they're having a convention starting on Friday.
The women?
In New York.
Really?
It's a women's cantor convention.
Yeah, you know, and that may be positive.
I'll go and find out.
Good. Let me know. But it could be negative as well. You know, it could have some serious... Because, you know, this business that... I mean, Joel Roth spoke so beautifully yesterday. But patience? Come on. I mean, patience... It's like telling the slaves, you know, be patient, you know. They had to be patient before Abraham Lincoln. They had to be patient until Martin Luther King. And they still have to be patient.
I think one of the things that the Rama envisioners didn't count on, they did count on, I'm sure, a certain number of rabbis and Hebrew teachers out of each batch of kids processed by this system, right? But what they didn't count on is that there would be a couple of girls in there who would want to be rabbis.
Yeah.
Not Hebrew teachers.
Yeah. Well, but you know, if it hadn't been Roma, I mean, the Reform movement has women rabbis and cantors, and the Reconstructionist movement. So
you think it's right around the corner?
I would hope so, because if it isn't right around the corner, then we're in for a long siege, as we were with the Vietnam War. You know, as America suffered terribly during that period. If we'd gotten out earlier, we would have been a healthier country.
Are you at all an activist among cantors for this sort of forward looking?
Yeah. Movement? Oh, I open my big mouth all the time. Yeah, sure. And at the Western Regional, Sub-Regional Convention that we had, I said this thing about sexism. Because I was hearing these sexist remarks, and Ivan Perlman was... took what I said very personally and took offense at what I said. You know, he said, "How dare you call me sexist?" I said, "Well, you may or may not be, but there's that underlying tone even throughout what you say and certainly throughout what other people say, whether they admit it or not, hiding behind the halacha. Halacha says a woman can't be a chazan, therefore a woman can't be a chazan. But that isn't true. Halacha doesn't really say that. Roth told us that people are hiding behind the halacha and using that as a front for their own self-protection and a form of bigotry, which is as bad as those sacrifices that the prophets preached against.
They said at Shoppers this morning there was a girl with a tefillin on her toes.
Mm-hmm.
One man who's not a cantor, who was a guest, said it was the Green Orthodox. First time he ever saw it, I said, "Well, how did you react?" He said, "Well, I'm here."
Bolt
of lightning didn't come out of the sky.
Right, right. You know, God didn't strike her dead. He didn't strike him dead. And that it isn't the end of the world.
Well, it's very refreshing to hear.
So,
you're probably one of the only politically aware people that we've talked to.
There aren't many of us. There really aren't.
Maybe a little easier in the West than it is in the East.
But I was this way in New York. I mean, I was a radical when I was at seminary. I got into all kinds of problems with the administration. It was at my insistence that we had the first boycott in the history of the seminary. We got rid of two tenured faculty members because of their incompetence. We started a faculty student curriculum review committee, which they had never had. Tried to bring them from treating us like kindergartners to treating us like graduate students. And for the 2 years that I was president, I mean, they were glad to see me go. I made their lives miserable because at every turn of events, I was saying to them, "You should be doing this, you should be doing that. How come Lazar Weiner isn't on the faculty?" You know, they finally got him, and then he died shortly thereafter, but at least they got him. You know, so I was always, I mean, from high school on, and certainly from college on, I had been a radical and somewhat anti-authoritarian.
Let me ask you a difficult question. I don't even know how to put it. Given an either-or situation where the calling of making the world a more fulfilling and better place for most people would conceivably meet head-on with the motive of bringing people closer to a religious experience or doing a religious defense. If there were a competition in your life over these two things, could you surmise which would win out? In other words,
I don't see them as being opposite.
Well, supposing you were asked to participate in a religious milieu, in a religious situation, which you knew was going to be divisive among people in some way, encourage ethnocentrism, nationalism. Do you know what I'm saying? And you must have been called on to do things like that. There have been certain passages in the Siddur, although they're probably not in the Siddur that you use.
Well, we use Likrat Shabbat, Machzor Chadash, so it's really the traditional text. Well, the Aleinu itself is a very chauvinistic prayer.
How do you deal with that? That's exactly the same.
Well, the Aleinu is very chauvinistic. On an intellectual level, I prefer the Reform Reconstructionist text. On an emotional level, I like the old words.
And you don't see them.
But I don't say them, I suppose I don't say them then with true kavanah. I say them more as an historical appreciation, in the same manner that one does the avoda service on your Paul Karim in avoda. At least when I do it, I'm not a high priest. I'm in a play. I'm demonstrating to the congregation what our ancestors did. I have no desire to go back to that. If we were to go back to the ancient temple, I'd be out of a job. I'm not a kohen. I'm not a levi. I'm not real interested, and I certainly don't believe in animal sacrifice. I'm not a vegetarian, but
so you conceive of all of that stuff as a metaphor,
mm-hmm.
of sorts,
mm-hmm.
a work of art, and so that you keep it from coming into conflict with your principles as a human being,
mm-hmm.
so to speak.
Yeah.
Now, do you make it clear to others that that's how it ought to be seen?
When asked, I don't always go out of my way, but this year I had a chance to do some teaching. The rabbi decided that as part of our adult education series, we would have shul and school. That instead of a sermon on Friday night, for three Friday nights in a row, and two sessions of that, that we'd have the full service, and then we'd break up into three classes, one taught by him, our educational director, and myself. And so one session I dealt with the prayer book, and we talked about the prayers. So I did have an opportunity to say that about things like the Aleinu. And the conservative does change some of the words. You know, the Silverman, yeah. And Likrat Shabbat, Machzor Chadash. Some of the words are changed. Not as much as the Reform movement, and not with the kind of thought that the Reconstructionist movement put into their Siddur. We had the Reconstructionist Machzor when I first came to San Bernardino, and 2 years ago we switched to the Machzor Chadash. So I had to change all the words when I first got there. I had to change the words, then I had to change them back again, which was fun. You know, it gave me a chance to rewrite some of the music and
they don't use a Reform synagogue?
No, not at all.
Yeah.
Not at all.
This is a very unusual Reform school.
Yes, well, but you have to realize that San Bernardino, first of all, is the largest geographical county, territorially, in the United States. And for 100 years, we were the only synagogue in the county, which encompassed San Bernardino and its environs and suburbs, all the way to the Arizona border, from the L.A. County border to the Arizona border, to the high desert, to Riverside and Palm Springs. So the high desert, the low desert, and the valleys.
Sounds like a like a third of a stone.
Well, I could probably, I don't know, somebody told me that you could drive, if you could drive the perimeter of San Bernardino County, it would take you 4 days to drive it. You can't, but if you could. The Mojave Desert is also in San Bernardino. It goes, you know, the Arizona-Nevada border and Los Angeles County.
So it decided to be a reform synagogue arbitrarily?
Yeah, more or less. Our emeritus was also a graduate of the Reform. And there was a time when they used the Reform prayer book, but we don't have any classical Reform people anymore. And we don't really have any Orthodox. We have some fairly traditional conservative. We have people who keep kosher. But we don't have anybody who is so shomer Shabbat that they won't ride. We have Oregon at, well, you could live around the synagogue, the area is okay. And some of the people who live around the synagogue walk. Some because it gives them the feeling that they're observing Shabbat, and others because they're into health. So we run a wide gamut. When I first came, our educational director at the time was a graduate of the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College. So we had a Reform rabbi, a Reconstructionist educator, and a conservative trained cantor. It was very ecumenical.
Sounds like a good mix.
Now our director of education has a double master's from HUC Los Angeles and USC in Jewish Communal Services and Gerontology. And she was the first one in her class to do this. It's a new field, combined field. She directs our school, our youth group, and our senior citizen program. So she is very Reform. In fact, we're more traditional liturgically than she has ever been used to.
It sounds like in general you're more traditional liturgically than you are philosophically.
Yes. Yeah, we are.
Theologically.
I like the traditional liturgy. There's something about it. I mean, I think the Catholic Church made a big mistake when they went away from Latin. Yeah, they really did. So I like the Hebrew. I like traditional Nusach. I like old recitatives. I'll take something from Joshua Lind and clean it up. I'll change the accentuation. I'll reduce the amount of textual repetition. But the neshama, the tam, taste, the feel, the soul of that old style recitative.
And it gets to your congregation too.
Yeah. Yeah, and I try and pick them that aren't solid recitative, that have a little tune in them. Or I'll take a tune from somewhere else and I'll weave it in. I do a lot of arranging. All of the music, practically all of the music that we use in my synagogue has been arranged to one extent or another, rewritten by me, or by one of my organists at my direction.
Do you publish any of this stuff?
No.
You thought about it?
Only minimally. I mean, it's not ready for publication. It would take a lot of work. I give it away, a lot. My friends, my colleagues. The older generation of Chazonim were very protective of their music. You had to buy it from them. Taube, Moshe Taube. You have to buy his recitatives, and you have to study them with him. A friend of mine is a student of Taube, was a student of Taube. And I gave Steve a lot of music over the years, and he gave me a couple of Taube's recitatives, including his Rosh Chodesh Benson, which I use all the time. It's glorious. It's got this little, at the end, toward the end, I've got this little high thing in B-flat minor at the very, very top, pianissimo. I'm a tenor, and I've got a nice light quality when I want to use it. And it's very, very soft, and then all of a sudden there's a stop, and then bam, on a high G-flat, fortissimo, and do it for the... When I see somebody new who hasn't been there, you know, they're there for the first time, you can always tell because they jump. But you get to them, you know. You know you've gotten to them. But I didn't do it the way Taube does it. You know, my way. So I'm willing to share this with other people, and my friends share with me, and I think that that's very necessary. I think that's a change in the cantorate that is coming, a more openness, more
a
spirit of cooperation,
and more guild.
Yeah.
Speaking of other things that you do, what other things do you do? In other words, what percentage of, how could you give us a rough breakdown of the percentage of how you spend your time? Or have you ever thought of those terms?
Well, I don't know about percentage, but I officiated all Friday night and Saturday morning services.
Trying to choir for
that. Choir I have on the High Holy Days and once or twice during the year on Friday night. Amateurs.
But does the choir rehearse?
Not all year, no. They rehearse before the High Holy Days very intensively, and then they're off at least until January. This year they didn't sing. They're not going to sing again until June the 8th.
Do you teach in school?
I teach, it depends on what they need, but I teach in a religious school. Either I teach a grade, or this year I was the Hebrew specialist. I had 3 Hebrew classes. I teach in adult education. I help the rabbi with the day-to-day administration of the temple. We don't have an administrative director, so he basically is it, but I help him with that.
Do you take part in other kind of pastoral activities, visiting people, going to shiva houses?
Shiva, yes.
Hospitals,
not much. The rabbi likes to cover them himself, and thank God it's not too much, you know, for him to handle. He can do it, and you know, we don't have that. We have a lot of people in the hospital, but not so many that.
So you, in other words, there's still a lot of time left for you to spend on politics.
Yeah, to some extent. The only other musical thing that I did this year that I think is of note is a friend of mine in San Bernardino is a composer. He composed a mass in memory of the Archbishop of El Salvador, who was murdered a few years ago, and the setting of the third psalm in English, and I sang the tenor solo in the mass in its premiere at the, quote, cathedral. We have a cathedral at the same time. It's not much of a cathedral, but we have a bishop. I did that a couple of years ago. This year, we did the premiere performance of his setting of 5 of Edgar Allan Poe's poems. It's a combination of 20th century avant-garde music and 19th century romantic ballad setting. We worked for 2 years on this. We finally
prepared the performance.
Yeah. And eventually he wants to record it. We probably would have recorded it already, but I got sick this year. It's a throat infection. I just got real busy. But we want to record it and do it as a show on public broadcasting. Vincent Price doing a narration or something like that. Well, he's in Los Angeles. So I have a few outside interests as well. We do a lot of interfaith work, both the rabbi and I. We do between 8 and 12 seders a year for churches. San Bernardino is the international headquarters of the Campus Crusade for Christ, which, among other things, helps sponsor the Jews for Jesus. We have 2 Mormon stakes in a city of 120,000. There are 164... Christian religious institutions listed in the yellow pages of the San Bernardino phone book alone. So
how many synagogues?
One.
Just
one. So we're really in the middle of a lot of it's fairly conservative, so fundamentalist Christianity. And we do a tremendous amount of interfaith work.
What did the client say to you on the phone then?
Oh, the client. The guy asked me if I was who I was, you know, and I said yes. And he said, "We at the Klan know how to deal with communists like you," or something like that. And I said, "Well, you know, I consider my actions to be a patriotic act." And I started to try and engage this guy in conversation. He hung up on me.
Yeah.
Then I unplugged the phones and left town for a month.
And no crosses burned on your lawn?
No. They didn't break into the apartment, so everything was fine.